My name is Owen Flynn and welcome to episode 123 of the Trail Running Ireland podcast, sponsored by New Leaf Online Health Store. In this week's show, we've got the man of the moment, John Kinsella, talking to us about his successful training block this summer, which resulted in an excellent run at the World Trail and Mountain Running Senior Championships, being the second Irish runner home in the 45-kilometre short trail race, second over 45 in the world at the World Masters Mountain Running Championships, and then going on to win the over 45 title at the National Marathon Championships 2 weeks ago now in Dublin in a time of 2 hours 26 minutes, as well as coaching the new sensation of Irish athletics, Ava Crean, to the Marathon National Senior title at just 19 years of age. Lots to talk about indeed with John. And then as always, we have the excellent Rennie Borg from Running Coach Ireland talking to us about the fourth performance pillar after VO2 max, lactate threshold and running economy, resilience. Everyone, get your running gear on. Let's go. Hey guys, how are you? Hope you're all good. And before we get to our chats with John and Rene, a super big thank you to our sponsor this month, New Leaf Online Health Store, owned by Imre runner and 100-mile UTMB finisher, Mairead O'Keefe. And Mairead and the team at New Leaf have a 10% discount code for all of our podcast listeners. So if you want to stock up on recovery nutrition for after your next big training run, or if you want to try any of their top endurance nutrition brands that they stock, such as Knack or Tailwind, for your next big race, pop over to newleafonline.ie, use the code FUELUP, lowercase or uppercase, and you'll get 10% off their full range of sports nutrition products. And you're also supporting an Irish business and an Irish mountain runner in Mairead as well. A few quick results to highlight, guys, before we start today. On the international racing front, at the Puglia by UTMB race in Italy, I think it was, Saoirse Lochnan had an outstanding third place finish in the 85k race there, with Joe Warren in seventh in the men's race, and Edna Cloak also had a top 10 run in the 50k. And then over in the Ultra X 50k race in Madeira last week, we also had two Irish runners in the top 10 there, with Barry Cullen 4th and David Dodrell 7th, with Barry taking home the over 40 win and Dave in 2nd over 40. And just over the weekend, friend of the show Ian Keat came home in 14th position in the very, very challenging Gran Canaria 360 Challenge Race, which is essentially a lap of the island of Gran Canaria. This year, just over 210 kilometres in very hot temperatures, a very tough race indeed. So congrats to Ian on his fifth finish in that particular race, and right up at the top end, the business end of the race as always as well. Before we call in Rene for our coaching slot, a big thank you to our group of Patreons who support the show each month. Lots of you have been with us for a very long time now. Thanks a million, guys. And if you are listening and like what we do, do please pop over to Patreon, Trail Running Ireland, and even a small donation of the cost of a gel per month will help keep us on the airwaves all year long. Okay, let's dial in Rene for our coaching chat and chat all things resilience. Rene Borg from Running Coach Ireland. Rene, great to have you back on, buddy, as it always is, every fortnight or so. And Rene, today we've got a two-parter. We're going to look at two very important topics, and two topics that are very much linked together: muscular endurance and the fourth pillar of performance, resilience. We're going to talk about a topic that's becoming hugely popular and relevant with endurance coaches: resilience. I think, Rennie, you're going to talk to us about how we've all heard of VO2 max, lactate threshold, running economy, but some coaches are now saying that there's a fourth performance pillar, resilience. Rene, tell us, what do you mean by that? And how then does it link to muscular endurance that we'll maybe talk about in part two?
Yes, so we come to the end of the year, so I thought it was good to do a double episode, like towards the end of a television series. So, but these two topics, they go so well together that I thought let's try and do them, because they've kind of come up in their discussion at around the same time, and that's obviously because they are related. And I think people probably recognize, most people who listen, those terms that you just threw out there, right? That people have always said, oh, but the three main determinants of how you perform in a race and in training is your engine size, which is what we call VO2 max, you know, your fuel efficiency, which is what's generally you see as your lactate threshold, and your mechanical economy, which means how much of the energy that you actually create are you able to show, you know, an actual physical forward motion. So that's what we call running economy. And those three together, if you measure them, and you could get them measured in a lab or you have them on your watches, they generally, if you track them, you know, if they are improving, so will your performance. But they seem to not 100% be able to describe it, you know, and they don't all do it at the same level. You know, we already, I think we might have mentioned that last week or so, or last podcast on, VO2 is a very weak determinant, actually. You know, so if you have a really high VO2, that often doesn't actually correlate very strongly to race performance. It just shows what your max potential might be if you become efficient, you know, and if you get a high lactate threshold. So that's all it shows, kind of what's, as I say, shows whether you're a big sports car or more of a Skoda.
Yeah, I think one of the stats, Rennie, that I came across there recently was that if you put, you know, 10 world-class athletes into a race, only... if you have 10 races with world-class athletes, in only one of the 10 races will the person with the highest VO2 max win. You know, something like that, that, as you said, it's not the most important factor at all. But there's so many other things that you're talking through there.
Yeah, exactly. So the obviously, good if it's high, you have better, you have a lot of potential, but you really need to train the others. Yeah. And what they found is, well, you can have all of these quite good, but you might still struggle to show it, especially in the longer distances like marathon and ultra. And what they then found is, well, there is another quality that they've decided to call resilience. And it's obviously a great word. I think most people understand it. And it's a little bit different from endurance. And, you know, it's related to muscular endurance, but it's not all about that. Really what it's about is that when you measure yourself in a test, let's say, you're fresh. And that's not usually what happens in a race. You know, when you really have to show how what you're made of and how your potential can, you know, be put out on the table, you have to do it when you're not fresh. You know, okay, at the start of the race, hopefully, if you taper right, you're fresh. But at quite a lot of the race, you're going to be operating under a lot of strain. And this is where resilience, so the ability to operate when fatigue accumulates, that's when the race is won or lost, or when, you know, getting the result you want is decided. So that means we really need to figure out, okay, so what is this resilience thing and how is that trained?
Okay, so the key question for me, Rene, when we're talking through the introduction there is resilience. Are we talking just about the mental toughness required to run an ultra or to run a marathon? Or is it something else, and that muscular endurance as well? Which is it, or is it a combination of the two?
Yeah, it's a combination. So the mental toughness is included, but there's much more to it than that. Because it'd be nice if it was just about, you know, having a strong mind. That'd be great. Yeah. Wouldn't it? You could just tough through. But it's your ability to maintain output, so power output under fatigue. You know, keep your form together, keep a good force production, you know, keep a good rhythm, all this, even when things are starting to fail. That means it comes from multiple different things. It comes from the muscles, comes from your metabolism. It can be neuromuscular. It means it has to do with the nervous system, and then mental, psychological. What does that mean? Well, actually, it means the brain, excuse me, is the final arbiter. So your brain looks at all those things and your brain decides, is it safe or not to keep producing the level of effort that this person wants to do? So that's kind of the starting point for understanding resilience.
And isn't that interesting, Rennie? Because I'm sure many of us have experienced over the years when that fatigue does set in and we just can't continue that race pace anymore. First of all, we might kind of analyze ourselves, okay, is it a fitness problem? And do I just not have the aerobic capability anymore to push on, as in I'm wrecked, I'm exhausted? Or is it sometimes, especially in road marathons, we might say, oh, you know what, you know what, you know, I could feel the freshness was still there. I still had energy to go on, but my calf muscle gave in or my quad gave in and I just couldn't generate the pace to get to a higher heart rate or whatever. But you're saying there that it's not maybe the aerobic, our aerobic conditioning, it's not maybe our muscular conditioning, that it's actually the brain that's calling time on our race pace and whatever distance it might be, that it's the brain that's controlling everything.
Yeah, so that's what the South African researcher Timothy Noakes, that a lot of people know because he wrote this big book called The Law of Running, and I think it's over 30 years ago now, nearly. He proved this theory he had called the central governor theory. So the idea is there that the way he proved it was, if you notice, people slow down in races, everybody does usually. But then even though they've slowed down and they've been barely functional maybe for a while, suddenly they sprint when they see the finish line. So when you look at that, you know that, well, there was always a reserve there. But for some reason, your brain, you know, kind of stopped you accessing it until it could see it was safe, right? Oh, there's the finish line. Now I release it because I know it'll be okay. He did many more experiments that kind of confirmed that this is actually how it works. Now, I actually, you know, I would go further, and I think he has to, it's the mind, not the brain, because they're not the same thing. You know, the mind is not just a product of the brain. But if we kind of forget that detail for a minute, it means that whatever, your mind is always scanning for threats, you know, muscle damage, energy imbalances, instability, you know, low blood salt, whatever it is, high body temperature. And when it thinks the risks look too high, it slows you down. So the brain has kind of like a tolerance where it knows where it's catastrophic and it'll stop you well short of that. You know, so it's a bit like, you know, the warning light in the car, that which I think we've talked about before as well. It'll start blinking, and that's basically the fatigue. And then when it goes empty and it stops you, it would be a little bit like if your car stopped you when it goes to zero, although there's actually still fuel in the tank.
Yeah.
Because the brain just doesn't want you to go there. So you can train the brain to release more and more to get closer and closer to this threshold. But your brain will always, no matter what you do, or your mind will always keep that reserve. So that's kind of one part of it. That's how it works. But it also means, well, if we need to convince the brain then to stop putting the brakes on too early, we need to minimize the amount of red lights that it sees, you know, so less muscle damage, less energy imbalance, less instability, lower body temperature, less tissue damage, all this, because then the brain will be like, oh, but it's safe to keep going. And that's, you know, the brain will then say, okay, let's keep the muscles functioning. And that would show up then as resilience, but you would have built it with local strength and durability from the muscular side.
Yeah. And I think that idea seems to have exploded recently in terms of that muscle strength requirement, muscle endurance, which is a big shift from the old fuel tank model, Rennie, where, you know, we were always talking about to make sure that we endure over a marathon, over an ultra distance, we need to make sure that we're getting enough fuel in, enough energy in. And it was all about the fuel. But maybe perhaps one of the reasons why we're talking about muscular endurance is because maybe we've cracked the code in terms of carbohydrates and fueling, and everybody kind of accepts now that, yeah, we need to be getting our carbohydrates in every 20 minutes, every 30 minutes. And then we move on to the next puzzle that we need to solve, and that's muscular endurance. What do you think is driving the current trend in conversation around the importance of that muscular endurance, Rennie?
It's two things. So one is that all sports and fields of study, you go through this cycle where you start by looking at the whole, and the whole is very complicated. So you start breaking it down into parts, and then sometimes you even like cut, like we do when you dissect an animal, right? You cut it into pieces and you look at the parts and you try and understand the whole, which is actually quite difficult. You know, if you look at a frog's leg, you don't learn a lot about a frog. Not really. So, but everything starts that way because the big problem, like, oh, human running performance, it's just too complicated when you start out. So when physiology started out and when coaches started out, they had to try and break the problem down, you know. So they broke it down into smaller and smaller pieces. Oh, you know, how do you metabolic engine and VO2, and eventually, but you forget that you still train the whole, and you get so focused on training the parts. And running went through that. Kind of coming into the 70s, 80s, they started to forget the whole picture and they focused too much on the parts. And now we're being wiser again. You know, we're coming out, we're starting to put them all back together. With the benefit of all that knowledge that was gathered, obviously, of by breaking it apart for many years and all the mistakes that led to. So what it means is, you know, now people realize, well, we're not just lungs on, we're not just engines on legs or lungs on legs or whatever it is, you know, that the whole body needs to be conditioned and looked after. You know, it's no good having tons of energy if the first thing that fails is the muscular system, you know, and obviously it was just very noticeable in ultras, especially because people quite often had extra energy. They could still eat and all this, but their legs were just gone. So, the people who were successful always get listened to, right? That's how it works. So when uphill athlete had Ruth Croft and, or was it Tom Evans, win the,
The two of them, yeah, two
yeah,
wins.
they had double winners of his big achievements. I mean, suddenly they were all over the podcast, and they were big into muscular endurance, you know, and they didn't invent it, but they did really formalize it well for ultra running in particular. And Scott Johnston, who was the main coach there, he took the ideas from a Russian researcher called Yuri Verkhoshansky, who was a Soviet scientist who wrote a lot of famous books in the 80s about the shock method. And the shock method was the foundation of what we call plyometric training today. So I came across that through a coach I met back in 2010, who used the same principles to develop, you know, force resistance circuits for runners. You know, to because they thought that was part of the foundation, you know. So the endurance world, in a way, have come full circle. They've come back to what Lydiard, Serrady, Bowerman already knew, you know. Lydiard with his hill circuit conditioning, Serrady with having people, you know, running up and down resistance on big sand dunes, Bowerman, who was big into strength training over at University of Oregon, you know, they all knew that, okay, you need a massive aerobic engine, but if the muscles can't handle it, you break down before you ever reach your aerobic limit. So that's really all that has happened. So yeah, we
Yeah,
come
and of
full
course,
circle.
we see that in the real world of racing, Rennie, as well. We see it in trail races. We see it in our ultra runners as well. That, you know, hips, glutes, stabilizers all begin to collapse far too soon. We see it in road marathons or in the final kilometer of a 10K, where that just muscular endurance isn't there. So resilience ties all of this together, doesn't it? It ties muscular endurance, metabolic ability, and of course the mental side of it as well. I think that's what you're saying today, that resilience, to be successful in our big races, we need to have those three boxes, muscular, metabolic, and the mental aspect side of things ticked off.
Yeah, I think the way we were summarizing where we had a chat before is that VO2 max, LT, and running economy, although they are also reductionist, really, you know, because there's more to those three numbers than just those three. But those three kind of tell you how fast you can go. Resilience tells you how long you can keep going that fast. And, you know, a good example would be that if you, this is a bit extreme, but like you could have super VO2, LT, and running economy, but if I break your leg, you're not going to go very fast because I just destroyed your resilience. Like, that's obviously, people say, well, that's a bit much, but okay, if you go with really good VO2, LT, and running economy, but you have Achilles, small Achilles tearing or something like that, or some other chronic injury, that's actually what determines how long you can keep going as fast as your physiological variables tell you. So that's why chronic niggles are such a huge issue, you know, because that straight away puts a big dampener on how high your resilience can be, you know, because that's the weakest link. So, you know, it's the what do you say, the most trainable part of that is the muscular endurance, or you could say the muscular and tendon system, really, because focusing on the muscular endurance is nearly reductionist as well, you know, because of course that's the specific attribute you want your muscles to have for endurance running, right? You want them to be able to keep repeating a certain force over time. And that has to be trained directly. As we talked about in some of the previous podcasts, running alone doesn't give it enough loading. There are certain types of running you can do, like, you know, Lydiard's hill circuits or really steep running with packs that does it. But generally, like, standard running actually can lower your strength. So that means, but there is more to it as well, because there's general muscular power often comes before. That's something we want to kind of cover a little bit more in the next podcast. We want to show you how to actually periodize it, you know, because you don't jump straight to muscular endurance always. It depends on your starting point. You might have to build some other skills first. If you, for instance, also have, you know, injuries, or maybe your tendons are very weak, or your cartilage or whatever, the training you need to do first needs to strengthen those tissues, you know, and then they're ready for, let's say, going out on a hill for 3 by 10 minutes with 15 kg on your back. You know, you don't go straight into that, but you have to take that mindset that it's one of the easiest ways to strengthen the body in a way that your mind will analyze what's going on when you perform and say, I still think it's safe for this guy to keep outputting this power.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think a lot of us runners have not wanted to hear it, because we are endurance athletes, and that means we prefer just going for a long time. You know, whereas a lot of the strength training is, it's a little bit counter to maybe the type of training we enjoy the most.
And it's always the one, Rennie, that would dip as well, isn't it? Like, if we have to do 5 or 6 runs per week, we'll prioritize those, and, you know, we'll leave that strength and conditioning session to last because it's probably the least enjoyable. But then it gets to the end of the week is gone, and we haven't done it because we've been out running, and then, you know, life just takes over. And it can be hard, can't it, to find that extra hour for that S&C, for that muscular endurance session. Can be very, very tricky.
Yeah, so hopefully the next segment, we can kind of give you an insight into how much is needed, because it's not as much as you think. You can do a lot, obviously. Like, if you have the time and inclination, you could do quite a lot. But if you just want to the minimum viable dose kind of thing, then I think we'll show you a way where it's not so bad. And I'm just working on an article as well, because I think we haven't done one of those for a while. So we'll put that up on the website so that when people jump off the next podcast, they can go have a read as well, because it's one of those things that's, it's a little bit better to see it in front of you. You know, if you want to compare, okay, what does the strength training and the, you could say, the strength focused running, what does it look like in the first part to the second, third, fourth part of training? It's better to look at it, you know, on black and white, because you can kind of, you can look column to column and say, okay, so a Tuesday in early training, that's the sort of strength I need to do. Tuesday in late training, oh, it looks like that. I can see the difference. And then you can see the whole journey, you know. But a lot of the stuff that we will be talking about, people have heard of a lot of it before. As I say, you know, long descents, eccentric loading, uphill tempos, you know, weighted hiking, hill circuits, plyometrics, all this good stuff. But the real takeaway today is just that at the end of the day, you need to create a system, everything in your body, that convinces your mind that it's safe to go to, you know, really tough limits. And that's a very integrated approach, you know, where you don't treat your body as parts. And I think that's why we tend to prioritize, oh, I'll just do the 5 runs if that's all I can do. Because we think that's the most bang for our buck, you know, just hammer only the aerobic system. And if we miss all the other parts, it's okay. Where maybe if we could change our thinking a bit, we would start to prioritize differently.
Yeah. Well, Rennie, absolutely. Next week, let's get into it. Let's go deeper into the how to actually build that resilience and that muscular endurance in our training. And without losing the aerobic base, Rennie, as well. Like, there yesterday, I was talking to one of my own athletes, and he was saying, oh, listen, you know, the aerobic conditioning isn't a problem. and now I want to focus on muscular endurance. And I said to him, you know, yes, the aerobic conditioning is good for this particular season, but don't think that you can't continue to improve that aerobic conditioning, especially for maybe any of our listeners that are only maybe running 2, 3, 4 years. Hopefully there's another 2, 3, 4 years of improvement still in your aerobic ability, your aerobic engine, and at the same time, adding in the muscular endurance without that, without losing your aerobic base, or without losing, Rennie, as well, the ability to continue to grow your aerobic base. You know, you can do the two things at the same time. Now, you mightn't be able to do fast or short sessions when you're building an aerobic engine and introducing muscular endurance and trying to do hard interval sessions or tempo sessions. And we might maybe get into that next week as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So training is not about taking things away. You know, it's about adding things.
Yeah.
But the whole reason we have periodization, as in periods with different emphasis, is that if you try and train everything all the time, obviously, some of the things will either interfere with each other, the body will get confused, or it'll just be too much, you know. So that's the reason. So it definitely is. That's part of what we want to show by showing how we periodize it, is that, yeah, you know, how do you change the emphasis? But there'll always be some of everything, you know, even if it's just a tiny bit. And certainly because we are aerobic runners, so you'll always have quite a significant amount of aerobic running in the total hours you spend, even if you have a week where the focus is very muscular, you know. So it's definitely not like, okay, for 3 months we go away, we barely run and we just hit the gym, you know. It's not going to be like that, no.
Exactly. Well, Rennie, I've got my weighted vest that just arrived from Amazon this morning. I'm looking forward to using that, doing my muscular endurance work with about maybe 10 kilos on top of me with my weighted vest. So I'll let you know how I get on with that in the next podcast as well, mate.
Yeah, please do. I have been on the fence of whether to get one, so you can tell me if it's
worthwhile. If it's good enough for the two UTMB champs of 2025, it's good enough for us, buddy. And sure, on that note, listen, let's leave it there for today, Rennie. And sure, we'll talk again for part two in about 2 weeks' time.
All right. Cheers, Owen. Have a good weekend.
Bye-bye.
For our special guest this week, he's a man who needs no introduction, but let me give John a quick intro all the same, as it brings a smile to my face as I read his achievements, as they really are so inspiring, as well as representing Ireland with distinction in senior and masters world championships on the mountains. John is the first Irishman and also the first male master over 40 worldwide to complete all 6 World Marathon Majors in just under 2 hours and 30 minutes. Not bad for someone who started running in their mid-30s. Let's dial in, John, and ask how he combines the roads and the mountains with such great success.
John Kinsella, John, you're an absolute gent, mate. Thanks a million for coming on, because I know you're on your holidays at the moment in the Canary Islands after an incredibly busy couple of weeks for you, John. So thanks a million for finding the time to come on.
No problem. I appreciate it. Good to be back on again and have a chat with yourself. And you're probably not that far away from me in another island, but if you were here, we might get a couple of hills.
Yeah, and it was 3 years ago, John, that you were on last. And so much has happened in the last 3 years, hasn't it? Highs and lows. The last couple of weeks, some tremendous highs. And what we were just saying, John, just before we came on, was that we mightn't talk about the main news story of the last 2 weeks and the incredible success of Ava and the national championship win in Dublin and our 2 hours 34, because, you know, we can see her journey on the great YouTube videos that you've been posting and some fantastic articles in the Irish Times, the local papers in Limerick as well. Where today, John, I wanted to ask you about what I think will be very, very useful for a lot of our listeners who would love to be able to combine successful running in the mountains with maybe the odd road marathon like Dublin a couple of weeks ago. Because, John, you've done it so well over the last couple of months, running for Ireland, coming second Irishman in the senior world championships, and then winning the over 45 title in Dublin and running the equivalent of a PB time for you the 2 hours 26, and just to talk to you, John, about how you managed to do it, really.
I ran, I think, 2:26 5 or 6 times now, and every time I did it, my training was totally different.
Really?
I've either been doing all hills. When I first ran 2:26, it was just really all road, because I was on my holidays in Poland and I was doing lots of mileage and real specific marathon training. And then a couple of times, like if you go back to even Boston this year, I was training for all hills, and then I just did a marathon pace run 2 weeks out, and a 10K marathon pace 1 week out, and I got 2:26 out of that, you know. So it's been, I said it's not a secret. It's just like do loads of running, and you know, I think you're always gonna have a capacity to do a certain time or a certain, you're always going to be a certain percentage of near what you what's in you to do, I think, anyway. And even if you're doing all hill training, you know, it's non-specific, but at the same time, it's still getting you very, very fit. And I think if I have a bit of belief then, and because every time I go into marathon now, I always think I'm going to run 5:35 a mile and see how far I can go with it. And sometimes I hang on and sometimes I fade slightly, but I know I'm going to get to 20 miles anyway before either the wheels come off or it's going to be a good day. So, and it's just, that's the way it is, you know, really.
Yeah, well, it's funny, John, that you mentioned that, because I remember talking to Gary Crozan a couple of years ago. Remember the great Gary Crozan, who was the National Irish Marathon Champion, I think, was it around the mid-2000s? And, you know, Gary spoke about how that he would have loved to have broken 2:20, because I think he won a lot of his national championships in 2:22, 2:23, around that. And he said that he tried everything. He tried high mileage with big long runs. He tried lower mileage with shorter, faster sessions, but he still couldn't break 2:20. It was still always around 2:21, 2:22. So, and you've just said kind of the same thing there, that once we're actually just consistent in our running, I think, and we're getting the volume and the mileage, you know, after we've been running that consistently for 6, 7 years, then we maybe hit a plateau, maybe. And the trick is maybe just trying to stay at that level and be consistent and you know, knock out the good times year after year, as opposed to, you know, maybe trying to, maybe worrying too much about this the specific sessions that you're doing, where the key, John, I think, is just to be running every week, every day, like you've been doing so well.
Yeah, definitely. Even like this year for the World Championships, like I said, I was doing a lot of training with Ava. So her marathon pace, we'll say, was around, if you go kilometers, around 3:39. So for me then, if I wanted to run a 2:26, that would, my aerobic threshold would be not far from that. So I was doing sessions with Ava, and then I was doing, like, I'd do like a double aerobic threshold session, and then I go up to the mountains maybe in that evening, and I'd end up doing maybe 1 hour at aerobic threshold or something, you know, specific to the hills then. So I had a good run in the World Championships off that type of training, just kind of balancing, you know, like, aerobic threshold work really shouldn't take that much audio because it's a low intensity, but I was doing a lot of it, and that got me very fit, and that's probably what got me a good race in the Worlds and a good marathon as well. You know, I wasn't trying to, you know, beat myself into shape. I was just building up from a lower intensity by doing a lot of volume of it, and it worked, you know.
Yeah, and I picked that up, John, on one of the YouTube videos there that you put up over the last week or two with Ava. And I think at one point you said, oh, that's 200 kilometers for the week, or something like that. And I heard that and went, Jesus, John's running 200 kilometers a week. And was that right, John? There was a couple of weeks where you were hitting 200K.
Yeah. That was my first time actually doing 200 kilometers. It was like, cause the way I work, like I find it very hard to go all in on everything. I mean, diet, strength and conditioning, running. Well, basically what happened before that was I did 5K at marathon pace, and my heart rate was nearly up by threshold. I knew then, like, there's no way I'm going to be able to run this sort of, you know, marathon down the line anyway. But I just, anytime I do a marathon pace run, it gives me an idea of my capacity at that time and what I need to work on. And then I was like, no, this is feeling way too hard to run marathon pace. So I said, I'm just going to do a big volume of mileage.
Yeah.
And 5 weeks, I did 90, and that was 110 or whatever that, whatever was 200K. It's,
About 124 miles, John. I got the calculator out.
Yeah, all right, 124
miles.
Yeah, so I did massive volume, and I didn't really, like I said, the only sessions I was doing was what I was doing with Ava, and then up and down maybe Keeper Hill, aerobic threshold or whatever, but
Yeah.
really low intensity. And it was just think, I'm going to do loads of miles. And after 5 weeks, I ran a 10K in training, we'll say a 5:25 a mile, and my heart rate was 5 beats lower than it was when I did marathon pace. Which is 10 seconds, you know, slower. So, I don't know, for me, the volume and the mileage gives me, you know, obviously it would get anyone a bigger capacity to do, you know, running, fast running. So, I try not to, like I said, I try not to whip myself into shape, but I usually go the opposite way and do lower intensity, but more volume. And that works for me, like.
That's fascinating, John. It really is. Did you find, John, that this it was easy enough for you to actually to stay healthy, John, when you're hitting 100 miles and not even 100 miles a week, 124 miles per week? Was the body breaking down at all, or was the fact that you were very strictly doing it at aerobic threshold and below, was that manageable for you? Because I'm sure for most people, John, who I presume you still work, John, last time we were talking 3 years ago, you were telling me about you were doing 12-hour shifts. I presume you still work. You haven't made your millions yet. So, you know,
I still work. I'm doing 8 to 4 now, so which is good. So I can, if I did 45 minutes on my lunch break, and then I'd top it up later. So I find a good balance there. And I was getting, we'll say, I would have done, my weekends would have been two kind of long ones, or sometimes it might be a long and a double on Saturday and a long on Sunday. And then the following Saturday, and top it up with another long one. So it was just a case of, I just had it in my head, okay, I'm going to do 200. Because I was doing maybe 150s, 160s. And then, like I said, it was all easy. Just I found it easy to add on. Yeah, I wasn't. If I was doing the 5-cycle shift like I was before, I probably would have broke down, and I probably would have struggled to recover. But it wasn't. I wasn't forcing myself to. I actually felt good. You know, I felt good when I did it. Like, because I wasn't doing any really hard sessions.
Yeah, no, mad. You know, 5K type work, 5x1K or 10x400s, all just good quality aerobic capacity. And then, John, like to get ready for the World Championships with the Irish team, where you did the short trail, 45 kilometers, alongside Enda Cloak, Luke Weldon, Gavin Byrne, a really good team that went over there. Did you find that you had to do technical mountain sessions where you're going up tricky ascents, you're doing technical downhill running? Did that interfere with your mileage build up towards Dublin and your training with Ava? How did you manage to get ready for the 45 kilometers and 6 hours of running in Canfranc?
Yeah, I was doing a lot of steep climbing, which is always my weakness before, because I was probably maybe 73 kilograms, but that's my weight, we'll say. But I was about 73 kilograms going into the race. And I was struggling against my peers going up on the climbs in mountain races. And, you know, because you're obviously, like, my VO2 max and someone else's VO2 max, it goes out the window when running economy comes into it going up a hill. So it was it's always something that I'm conscious about, that I made a conscious effort to work on my steep climbs, like 30% gradient. And there was a couple of climbs, then I mean the silver mines. So it goes on for about a kilometre. So it probably took about 30 minutes to get up that 1K of a climb, and you're getting 1,000 feet at the top of it. So I just got good at that, as in years ago when I was racing, I used to hate that in races, and I used to think, oh, I'm bad. But my mindset just changed. It was like, it has to be done, and I have to just get used to finding the pace that I know that I can make a deal with my brain that, like, this is horrible, but I can maintain this for as a long time. And that's the way it is in Mount the long mountain races now. When I'm racing against them, it's like, I know it's going to be horrible, but it's going to end at some point. And I just go get into kind of a flow then. So I don't really hate the climbs anymore.
And that climbing that you were doing in training, it stood to you then for the strength needed to run a very hilly Dublin marathon course as well. It didn't interfere with your marathon training on the flat. And it sounded like, John, it was just a perfect combination for you and a fantastic couple of months training over the summertime and the lead up to the Worlds and then to Dublin. Just really enjoyable. Steady running and not killing yourself with hard 5K, 10K type work, just lots of enjoyable running.
Yeah, like if you go back to last year, I came back from the Euros and I haven't done any speed work whatsoever, any 10K or 5K. And if someone said to me, go out and run a mile in 5 minutes, I said, I can't do it. And I went, and like a couple of weeks after the Euros, I did a mountain race, my luck, I think, hard race. And then I did a local 10K and I ran 32:20. And then I went to. I went to Dundrum there in 31:03 without doing any speed work whatsoever. Just my high aerobic stuff, VO2 max stuff was all just hill running, and I didn't do one any. I didn't even run a kilometer at, we'll say, 3:15 pace or whatever it was, or whatever 5 minute pace is. And I went out around 31:03 without doing any speed work. So it, you know, the hills, I. The hills are my hard stuff, and then you know, I do a lot of marathon pace stuff and I do a lot of aerobic threshold stuff, and that's what I just find works for me, because it doesn't kill me as much as doing maybe hard VO2 max reps. Like, so a lot some people do a lot of 1K reps and stuff, but I never do anything like that really.
Incredible. John, how do you feel, John, now, say, coming out of that block in preparation for the World Championships and then the Dublin Marathon build-up, the execution of the 2:26 in Dublin, taking the gold medal in the over 45 category? How does the body feel now, John, after that summer? Like, do you need to go away and rest for a couple of weeks, or are you actually beginning to freshen up now that we're nearly 2 weeks post-Dublin now?
Yeah, look, I feel good. What I did after the Worlds was I took a week off, and I never take any time off. I just took a full week off, no running whatsoever. And I knew if I wanted to run Dublin, I have to just be fresh, because you're not going to lose that fitness. You're not going to lose it straight away. And it was just the case of get my body fresh, we'll say, letting it recover from that 6 hour run. And then I just did marathon pace. And then I did 21K at marathon pace. So I ran 1:13, 1:12:43 in training 2 weeks before Dublin, after a few days, I suppose, after coming back. And I knew then, my heart rate was good. I was happy with the data. I said, yeah, I'm definitely going to go out and run at this pace. And it worked out for me. Like, so I didn't do it. Like I said, I didn't do anything faster than I did one session a week before Dublin, then where I did a bit marathon pace and then maybe a threshold rep and then a fast rep, and that's all I did. And it got me there, and I felt good. I felt good. I think a lot of the times, like I said, we tried to train too hard, and now I just know if I go into any race and I'm feeling fresh, I'm going to have a good run, and I'm going to be able to run 5:35 a mile till at least 20 miles, and then after that, it's a marathon. You just got to dig in, I suppose, and hope everything doesn't start shutting down.
John, it's funny. I was watching a video, another video on YouTube the other day after I was watching the one that you did with Ava, and it was a day in the life with Haaland from Manchester City. And
Yeah.
talking through how he keeps himself fit and healthy and the superfoods that he was eating. He's in a nice bath every day, infrared sauna, etc., massages every day. Like, do you need to keep on top of stuff like that, John, yourself, with ice baths and super nutrition? When you are running 124, 125 miles a week, or would you just say, no, to be honest, I'm just living a normal life. I'm not in a nice bath every day. How's the body? How is the body staying healthy, do you reckon?
I think it's just A bit of luck, definitely. And if I could do all those things Haaland was doing, I definitely feel a lot better. But I don't do anything like that. If someone sponsored me, I do it every day, but I can't. Just the reality of it. And I think it's because I started running when I was 35, so I suppose this will be 10 years running. Maybe I'm not after reaching my peak yet. I hope anyway, because the first couple of years I was doing maybe only 40 or 50 miles a week, and then it's only recently, the last couple of years, I started, when I tried to break 230, I started putting a big emphasis on big volume and big mileage. But I have, like I said, I have a family. My partner works even sometimes, and I'm limited in a lot of things I can do. I can't just go to a sauna or go to a gym or anything like that. So I definitely think, like, for 99% of the time, my diet's usually pretty good, and I could definitely do a lot more strength and conditioning. But I'm probably the most inflexible person ever. Like, but I can still like jump around if it's like. I think my soccer things actually stood to me. All those, like the plyometrics and stuff I used to do years ago every day nearly, because I was a coach as well, and I could go on and do ladders there, and I could fly through a ladder like the fittest soccer player around. I still have that reactivity, and I think it definitely helps. It translated into running, because it kind of keeps me able to handle fast paces and lots of volume, because I think my tendons and my Achilles and stuff are just really strong after years and years of jumping up and down as a goalkeeper and doing soccer drills and stuff. And then when I came into the running, then I had this base, and it would have been similar to Eva. She came from a very sporty background as well, and these are things that people don't really count, when it comes to running, but they have a massive impact on you in the future if you've developed all these things before you started running.
Maybe two quick technical questions, John, before I let you get back there to the swimming pool in Tenerife. In terms of nutrition, John, for the World Championships and the 6 hours, and then your nutrition for the Dublin Marathon, what was it similar? Was it very different for the two events? Were you getting, your gels into you every half an hour, the standardized approach, or were you doing anything majorly different between the two races?
Yeah, so in Canfranc, obviously it was going to be two aid stations, and I broke the race down to the two aid stations. So to be honest, I took about 100, I could take about 100, I'd say, calories an hour, I guess, because I took Morton 320, and then I took three gels, and that got me to the first aid station at around 16K, and then I did the same again, and I didn't take any electrolytes. Like, when I did the qualifier, my legs just seized up. It was my first time running a past 4.5 hours up in Granite Peaks, but it was a brutal race, and my everything just seized up, my calves especially. And I didn't take one sodium tablet in Canfranc, and I got no cramps. I think it's just I put my body through it in the qualifier, and my body just adapted to that. And the 6 hours felt normal, and I was able to do it. And then in Dublin, it's just the standard thing. I take a gel every 20 minutes, which is easy to remember: 20, 40, 60, 120, 140. And then I have six after 2 hours. And for the last half hour, it's just about digging in,
Well, that's interesting, John, that it's actually every 20 minutes you're taking a gel. In the past, I've done every half an hour, but you're even pushing the boat out more in terms of getting even more carbs in because it's every 20 minutes. So you're actually getting what, four gels in on 0, 20, 40, and 60. So yeah, you're hitting close to 100 grams of carbs per hour.
Yeah, I can tolerate. Like, I could take more, and I probably wouldn't have any problem with it. And I take them on early. Like I said, I think a gel, when you get to the last half hour in a marathon, a gel is probably not going to do nothing for you. If you're low on glycogen at that stage, like, you probably have so much fatigue built up that you're never really going to recover from it. But
Are you actually, John, carrying the gels yourself, or do you have somebody out on the course giving you the
Carry on, yeah, old school now.
gels?
I got the mother-in-law to make these shorts of me. Probably
Oh, very
similar to
good.
Scullion's ones, but these ones, I have three pockets. I put two caffeine in one, and electrolyte one maybe and on a different one. So just so I know where everything is. But it's I the first couple of marathons I did, I was only taking one every maybe 5 miles. I think I did my first Dublin, and I took a gel at 5 mile 10, and it was like I did it in Berlin. That was nothing, like, really. When I look back now, like, even that extra, like, I'm taking six now, but that extra two makes a massive difference, like, in the
Yeah, no,
marathon.
it's a great tip. John, shoes of choice for the World Championships on the trails and then the shoes that you wore in Dublin?
I wore the lightest shoes I could think of in the in Cairn Franc, and it was a big mistake because they only had 2.5 mil lug. And the very first hill, I fell and I got a bad fall. And I ended up hitting my chin off a rock, and if I put my head down another bit, it would have broke my teeth. But that kind of that fall just got me very winded in, and I was actually making more time going up on the hills, which is not like me, but. Yeah, I fell, I had a bad fall, and I was ahead. I think I was not far behind the winner, the female winner on the first climb, and I fell then, and then Scott Adkin, a couple of other people passed me, and that was the trend for the rest of the race. So if I had to do it again, I'd definitely pick something with a better grip, because
Okay.
I like something with I like something with a good grip. But I wore the Salomon Pulsar Trails, the very light ones, like 200 grams. And then Alpha Flies, I think, are king for the marathon for me anyway. I love
Alpha Flies,
them.
yeah. Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. Well, listen, John, maybe one last question, John, before you go. John, you've achieved so much in the last couple of years, from the World Championships there with Ireland, over 45 national marathon champion, as well as, the fantastic record that you have in Berlin, Boston, Chicago, London, New York, and Tokyo. What's next, John, for you? What would you like to do in 2026?
Yeah, like, because when you come into the Masters, like I said, there's only so much, only so long you can keep up with the younger fellas. But I think now my goals have changed. If I do the majors, I want to try to get on the podium in the age category. I did it in Boston, and I did it in Chicago. So I'd like to actually do that in all the majors if I end up doing them again. So it's something that keeps me in the game anyway, and whether I go back and do senior or not, it's debatable. I might just try run a PB. I feel I can run a PB in a marathon, so that's my goal for next year.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And you'll be kept busy, I'm sure, with all the back to Boston guys, girls as well. And will you be heading over, John, in April to Boston?
I have an entry for it. I want to go over, and some Spanish guy beat me last year. He was in the elite category, Spanish runner. He ran 2:23 or 2:24. So,
I think that was Pablo Villalobos, John. I remember. And Pablo Villalobos,
possibly, yeah.
He's Olympic standard, so to be in the same mix with Pablo, John, is superb. Fair play.
Yeah, I'm coming after Pablo next year anyway.
Well, listen, John, thanks a million for taking a half an hour out of your holiday. Congratulations on all your wonderful success to yourself, to Ava, all the team, and back to Boston as well. And John, looking forward to seeing you in action, mate, in 2026 again. Well done.
And actually, I have one more question for you, because you're M45 as well. When are you going to come and join the Masters team, and we take over the world or Europe as the
Oh, John,
M45, Ian
give me a race, give me
Conroy?
a date, and I'll be there, John. Absolutely. Hopefully, I'll be back for the cross country in February. And if there's a European or Worlds next year in 26, sign me up, mate. Sign me up.
There is. Ian Conroy is 45 as well, so we'll have a good team.
Yeah, sure. Well, we were over 35
All
world
right.
champions there a couple of years ago, John. Do you remember when that's when we first got to meet each other? So hopefully we can repeat that in the over 45 category, mate. Absolutely.
Well, there we have it, guys. Hope you enjoyed the chat with John. And as a little anecdote on the chat with John there last Friday, we were scheduled to talk on the Thursday. And when I dialed through to John, he was literally hanging off the side of a mountain in Tenerife in his full running gear after a training run went a little longer than expected. So certainly a first for me to dial in one of our special guests while they are literally out running up a mountain. So fair play, John, for coming back on the Friday. And good to see you got back home safely from that tricky run on the Thursday, and thanks for coming on, mate, again. And thanks also to, of course, Rene for our fantastic coaching slot as always, and good luck to everyone in the build up to Run the Line on Saturday 22nd, a very popular race on the Irish racing calendar, and of course a race which raises funds for the Dublin Wicklow Mountain Rescue Team, a very worthy cause indeed. And a quick reminder before I go to use that code FUELUP, uppercase or lowercase, for 10% off all your sports nutrition and supplement needs on Irish store newleafonline.ie, where mountain runner and proud UTMB finisher Mairead O'Keefe and the team will be more than happy to help you out. Everybody, get your running gear on. Let's go.